Morning, it is 11 a.m. on Friday, December 6th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we'll be covering the challenges posed by the ongoing Canada Post strike for Kingston's local nonprofits, an upcoming move for partners in Mission Food Bank, the verdict of Councillor Jeff McLaren's Integrity Commission investigation from Tuesday's council meeting, updates directly from the City of Kingston, and more. As the Canada Post strike enters its third week, local nonprofit and charity organizations are seeing an impact on their donations and annual fundraisers. The strike comes at a critical time of the year for many charities. According to surveys conducted by the Association of Fundraising Professionals, many charities receive at least half of their annual donations during the final 3 months of the year, with December being the most important month. According to a poll conducted for Canada Helps in 2023, nearly a quarter of Canadians expect to require charitable services for basic needs such as food, shelter, and health services. As for Kingston's local organizations, many have already experienced or anticipate an impact on their donations. Courtney Murphy with Onguinata Resource Center, an organization dedicated to supporting people with developmental disabilities in Kingston, expressed that they have already seen an impact on their donations.
Onguinata does receive donations via mail, and it has been impacting our organization. As you know, this time of year is when a lot of people tend to give, so it has impacted us. People, for some reason, are still hesitant, we find, to donate online, even though it's a secure transaction. I think it has to do with demographics. The older demographic tends to be a little bit more hesitant about those online donations.
The Kingston Humane Society, normally in the full swing of their annual fundraiser, have been seeing a significant decline in donations. Executive Director Gord Hunter had the following to say on the topic. Have you experienced or do you foresee an impact on donations due to the Canada Post strike?
We have experienced a significant impact to this point, Christina. So normally by now we'd be 2 weeks into our direct mail campaign, and we would see probably in the neighborhood already of about $30,000 in donations. We haven't reached the $20,000 mark yet, so we are significantly behind, and I firmly believe that the large majority of the reason for that is we can't get any mail in. So a lot of our donors, especially the donors who donate larger amounts, like 250, 500, mm-hmm. sometimes even 1,000, they donate by check. And when they do that, obviously they mail it in, and we've gotten no mail. So it's had a really substantial impact on our campaign to this point.
Are the holidays normally a large influx for you for donations?
Yeah, so this direct mail campaign, we send out usually the second or third week in November. And we do that because people are more inclined to give at this time of year, but also they're thinking about, you know, we're able to give them a tax receipt. So they're thinking about, you know, end of year and getting their any donations they want to get, getting tax receipts so that they can claim that on their income tax, which is great. It's a win-win for us and for the donors. So normally we get in the neighborhood of $130,000 to $140,000 from this campaign, which is 25% of our general donations for the entire year. So it's our biggest fundraiser by far. It's our most important fundraiser by far, and it's one that I think people really enjoy participating in at this time of year.
CFRC also received a written statement from Salvation Army Kingston, reporting that their numbers are down this year at the start of their annual hamper and toy drive campaigns. They anticipate a significant impact as many of their donors mail in their donations. However, in spite of the challenges introduced by the strike, Kingston organizations and donors have been finding creative ways to carry on with fundraising efforts. Organizations shared how they have adapted by sending additional digital newsletters, making calls, adding drop-off sites, accepting donations over the phone, and making it easier to donate online. Executive Director Gord Hunter explained how the Kingston Humane Society was able to partner with local pet stores to collect donations.
One of the things that really kind of lifted my heart was we had a recent finance committee meeting, and our treasurer said, why don't we see if the local pet stores will accept envelopes for us? Because a lot of our donors, obviously, are animal owners as well, and they're going to get pet food and restock, and maybe they can take their checks in, drop them off if the pet stores are willing to take them, and then we can go pick them up. Sure enough, when I reached out to them the next day after that finance committee meeting, 7 pet stores stepped up right away and said, absolutely, we'll do this. So we pretty much have the geography of Kingston covered in terms of the pet stores that are willing to take in envelopes, sealed envelopes with checks in them as donations for that campaign. So we're really hopeful that that gives people an outlet until the strike is over. To know that our community partners and supporters are so willing to step up and help, it really, like I said, it really made us feel good about our chances of reaching our goal for the campaign.
Dan Irwin, executive director with Partners in Mission Food Bank, also stated he's hopeful donors will find ways around the strike.
Kingstonians have always found a way to help us and ensure we're well supported, which we're very grateful for. So I suspect they will be resilient and find some ways to get their money to us again.
It was decided that Meadowbrook Strathcona Councillor Jeff McLaren will receive a formal reprimand from council and a 30-day pay suspension for disclosing confidential information. Councillor McLaren has been under investigation since the rest of council filed a formal complaint with the Integrity Commissioner in February 2023. McLaren was accused of contravening the city's member code of conduct by disclosing confidential closed meeting information. The information in question was leaked in email exchanges with community members, presumably regarding an issue in his district. Throughout this process, McLaren has maintained his innocence, claiming that all of the information in the emails had already been made public and even broadcast on local news media. The report, which found McLaren guilty of these code violations and recommended a reprimand and docked pay, was presented to council at Tuesday night's meeting. A heavily redacted version of the report was also released to the public. After accusing the Integrity Commission of, quote, a tyrannical abuse of power, McLaren had the following to say in his defense before a vote was called to move forward with the recommendations.
I am accused of linking 2 public pieces of information without authorization. My argument in defense is that the two public pieces of information were already linked legitimately by authorized city spokespeople.
McLaren was also asked a few follow-up questions by Councillor Lisa Osanek during the discussion.
Wanted to ask Councillor McLaren if if he sees that he benefited in any way out of this situation.
I most certainly did not have any benefit out of this situation. It has cost me personally a huge amount of time, money, energy, and the goodwill of my colleagues here quite often. This was imposed on me.
Okay.
Definitely not wanted. It was painful.
And I just wondered, in Counselor McLaren's opinion, if he thinks the penalty is proportional.
Based on the case law that was quoted by the Integrity Commissioner, this is excessive.
As counselors discussed the issue around the horseshoe, Counselor Osanek started off the discussion in defense of McLaren.
I think that any one of us could have acted in the same way if it happened in our district. I really do. You got to put yourself into our fellow counselor's shoes for this.
Counselor Connie Glenn seconded Osanek's point, adding that a harsh punishment could have a negative impact on future discussions.
And I do agree with Counselor Osanek that there's a very slippery slope here, and we all could have found ourselves in a situation where we accidentally disclosed something. As we're talking about this evening, we are being painfully cautious not to discuss anything that we've already discussed in closed. I know that we, you know, have received training in this matter, but I think it's very difficult to suss out when exactly we can talk about some things and when we can't. Timing matters. And so my concern is that if we are very punitive with each other, we are going to silence good discussion and good debate because we're too afraid to speak when we actually could speak. So I think be cautious in what you decide to vote for. In this case, I don't think that the penalty is justified.
Counselors Gregory Ridge and Brandon Tozzo disagreed with Glenn and Osanek, zeroing in on the importance of neutrality and the integrity office as a third-party decision-maker in their arguments.
There's been some conversation around this table with regards to punishing each other, but this is in fact the most neutral process with regards to accepting a recommendation for punishment or sanctions or however you want to call it. And I think that if any of us finds ourselves in this situation in the future, we would want to ensure that there's neutrality with regards to those recommendations, and we should take the recommendations that the Integrity Commissioner has put forward. I think that that is the best path forward for us, and then that's the way that we should move with this and any other future instances.
We have to take this out of the politics around the horseshoe and leave it to what is effectively a separate entity.
Counselor Ryan Boehm also underwent this process in 2023, when council requested to have the Integrity Commissioner look into a vote Boehm cast during budget discussions. Boehm also took the side of accepting the report's recommendations, urging McLaren to take the punishment and move on.
I think in this case, it'd be very hard to go to the public and say, well, yes, this happened, but we deemed it as a council to go against the Integrity Commissioner's advice. And then it's literally just going to keep this thing going because the public's going to say, well, something wrong happened, it seems, whatever that may be based on the report, but there was no real penalty there. So, I mean, I sort of can put myself somewhat in the shoes of if I was in this exact position, it's kind of like take the hit, stop talking about it, take the punishment and just move on. And the public will decide that, okay, you've learned something, you've moved on.
Both consequences were separated for the vote. The decision for McLaren to receive a formal reprimand passed with a vote of 10-2, while the 30-day pay suspension passed with a vote of 9-3. Kingston has joined the growing number of municipalities requesting a portion of the provincial land transfer tax and goods and service tax go to municipalities as a source of steady infrastructure funding. Currently, municipalities do not receive a share of the provincial land transfer tax, collected by the Ontario government on property transactions to municipalities. The same goes for GST, collected by the federal government. The motion that came before council on Tuesday states the current sources of municipal revenue, including property taxes and user fees, are insufficient to meet growing infrastructure needs, including work on roads, bridges, public transit, water systems, and other critical services. The importance of predictable and sustainable funding, allowing for better planning and long-term infrastructure initiatives, is also stressed in the request. Councillor Ryan Boehm, who brought the motion forward, had the following to say.
It's as simple as what it says. We know we're struggling. Good example, police budgets are going up. Everything seems to be going up, and revenues seem to be stagnating or not keeping up. So this is just one more way that we can join a chorus of other municipalities in asking for sustained funding from the province.
As Councillor Boehm mentioned, many other municipalities, including Durham, Aurora, Loyalist, and Brantford, have made the same request. Councillor Connie Glenn, who was attending the meeting remotely while at a conference hosted by the Ontario Federation of Municipalities, spoke to the importance of establishing sustainable funding and larger conversations happening amongst municipal leaders.
I'm actually at Advocacy Days right now with the Federation of Canadian Municipalities. And so a new municipal growth framework is one of the key things that we're discussing. So this dovetails into that. I'm not sure if this will be the way that it goes, but sustainable funding is really what's on the table here. We are talking about all the other pressing needs that municipalities have, but at the end of the day, it comes back to what can be funded. So there has been, I think, some very honest discussion already that whether it's this government remains or whether we have a new government after the following election, that we're likely not to see as much movement as we would hope on the fiscal front. So one of the pressing things that we're trying to get across is that if we aren't getting that much of an increase in funding, that we at least get sustainable funding.
The motion passed unanimously, and a copy of the request was forwarded to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Premier Doug Ford, as well as other relevant officials and all 444 municipalities in Ontario. Partners in Mission Food Bank is officially making the move to a new, larger space to accommodate for increased demand. Partners in Mission is currently located at 140 Hickson Avenue and has been there since 2003. However, as demand continues to rise in the Kingston community, with the organization helping over 8,000 Kingstonians in 2023, Partners in Mission now finds themselves in need for more space for storage, volunteers, and those seeking services. It has been announced that in 2025, Partners in Mission will be making the move just 25 meters away to 4 Harvey Street. I sat down with Dan Irwin, Executive Director of Partners in Mission Food Bank, to discuss the move. Partners in Mission is officially set to move to a new location. What challenges are you experiencing at your current location that made you decide this is a needed change?
Yeah, well, we're in what's going to be our fourth year in a row with record numbers, and we've just maxed out at what we can do here. Unfortunately, we're so full that our clients are unable to come into the building, so they're waiting outside in all sorts of terrible weather, and that's just not something we're comfortable with. So our new space is going to enable our clients to come inside. It's a shopping model, so they'll be able to choose the food they want, so it's going to be a much better experience for them.
And the new location is just a few meters up the street. How much more space will this provide? What's the jump here?
Yeah, so we're going to double our space. Our total square footage in this building is just around 8,000, and the new building will be 17,500.
Were the funds for this move achieved through fundraising?
Yeah, so we've known that this building had limitations and that we're growing so fast. So we've been trying to put money away. So that's what we've been working towards. We're also fundraising right now to help with the renovations. We're looking for $1 million for our renovations. We're at right around the $350,000 mark. So we're still got a ways to go to help us to get these renovations paid for.
And you will still be at your current location during the busy holiday season. What challenges does that present, and what's the plan for the next few months?
Yeah, so right now we're at busy season, so it's going to get very full in here. We've got some awesome volunteers, 130 of them, who are doing their best to squeeze in here and there, and we're going to do that. That's kind of what we do here. We play the Jenga game, and we manage to get everything stacked up safely, and we still help the clients that need it. We'll be here until we're expecting a move date sometime in March. We'll firm that up as we get closer. We're just going to tighten it up, and we'll make it do.
How can folks donate if they'd like to support the move?
If they want to help support us, they go to kingstonfoodbank.ca, and there's a donate button, and right there they hit that donate button and make a donation to us. If If I can also add, if anyone needs help, they should call us. We're in the busy time, so you need to call us as soon as possible, 613-544-4100, and that's Monday to Friday.
Once again, that was Executive Director Dan Irwin with Partners in Mission Food Bank, sitting down with CFRC to discuss the organization's move to a new and larger space in the spring. Partners in Mission is currently sitting just above the $250,000 mark on their way to fundraising $1 million for renovations. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today, featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell. For your weather report this morning, today we're expecting sunny skies, then a mix of sun and cloud with a 40% chance of flurries late this afternoon. Winds will be 20 kilometers per hour, becoming light late in the afternoon. We have a high of -3 with wind chill that's going to feel like -14 in the morning and -9 in the afternoon. We have a UV index of 1 or low. Tonight we're expecting mainly cloudy skies with a 40% chance of flurries. Winds will be 20 kilometers per hour, becoming light late in the evening. We have a low of -7 with wind chill that's going to feel like near -10. On Saturday, December 7th, we're expecting cloudy skies with a 40% chance of flurries and a high of -3. Saturday night, we'll have the same conditions with a low of -2. On Sunday, December 8th, we're expecting cloudy skies with a high of +5. And Sunday night, cloudy skies with a low of -1. Looking forward to next week, we're expecting some showers and some temperatures in the positives. That wraps up your weather for this morning, and next up is your traffic report with Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with your traffic report for the week of December 2nd, 2024. We begin with a quick note from the Ministry of Transportation. Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard westbound off-ramp will be closed from Monday, December 2nd at 8 p.m. to Tuesday, December 3rd at 6 a.m. to complete line painting on the off-ramp. Other road closures. Abbeydon Road, Highway 2 to Middle will be closed to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert is closed until December 31st to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Collingwood Street, Earl to Union is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Cooper Street, Albert to Collingwood is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Hillcrest Avenue, Kings Court to 7th is closed for buried infrastructure replacement. Road will be open to local traffic, however. Kings Court Avenue, Hillcrest to Kirkpatrick is closed to accommodate a water main replacement. Union Street, Willingdon to Albert is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. And University Avenue, Union to Earl is closed for construction related to the Queens J-Duck project. Here are some other delays to keep an eye on this week. Aberdeen Street, Johnson to Earl, expect delays and closures along Aberdeen for a contractor to complete road and sewer reconstruction. Bayridge Drive, Princess to Taylor Kidd, expect delays while a contractor begins Phase 2 of the Bayridge Drive active transportation upgrades. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles to Edwin and Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes Phase 2 of the Princess and Collins Bay active transportation improvements. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal updates, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard at Elmwood. Expect delays while a contractor upgrades the intersection at Sir John A. McDonald Boulevard and Elmwood Street, including replacement of street lighting, new traffic lights, replacement of asphalt on roadways, and a new multi-use pathway south of the intersection towards Bath Road. And that's a wrap for your City of Kingston traffic report for the week of Monday, December 2nd, 2024.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. In a message directly from the City of Kingston, the Kinsmen Club of Kingston has donated $100,000 in support of the Inclusive Play Project. Over the past year, a significant number of community volunteers have worked tirelessly to raise funds towards the goal of building Kingston's first fully inclusive and accessible playground. The Inclusive Playground was approved by City Council to be built on the site of Shannon Park. With the generous donation from Kinsmen Club of Kingston, The Inclusive Play Project has raised close to $600,000 and continues to work alongside city staff to apply for grants and pursue donations, sponsorships, and naming rights opportunities. The cost of the region's fully inclusive playground is expected to be approximately $1.5 million. In a statement from the Kinsmen Club of Kingston, they state, quote, "Our club believes that every child should be able to experience the joys of childhood. And what greater childhood joy than going to the park? The Inclusive Play Project is an important step toward ensuring that all children in this community will have access to that joy, and we couldn't be happier to help realize that," end quote. More information about supporting the project with corporate sponsorship, in-kind donations, and financial donations can be found on the Inclusive Play Project website. Once again, that was a message directly from the City of Kingston providing an update on the Inclusive Play Project. In another message directly from the city has announced Extend a Family Kingston as the recipient of the 2025 Kingston Community Climate Action Fund for its Growability Hydroponic Greenhouse Project. This initiative aims to address the city's climate action goals while fostering sustainability, inclusivity, and local food security in the community. The Growability Hydroponic Greenhouse Project will upgrade and scale the operations of two hydroponic greenhouses that are capable of producing over 20,000 heads of fresh, locally grown produce each year. Previously, Extend a Family Kingston was a Climate Action Fund participant in 2020 to 2021, installing its first Dunya hydroponic greenhouse unit. By utilizing hydroponic technology, the project will use 90% less water than traditional farming, eliminating the need for soil, avoiding greenhouse gas emissions from transportation, and increasing climate resiliency by sustainably producing local food year-round. The Climate Action Fund fundraising goal for this project is $30,000. Fundraising will take place from December 2024 through March 2025, and 100% of the funds raised will go to the Extend a Family project. Ian Cholmoldley, Extend a Family, Kingston's Program Manager of Innovation, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, states, quote, "Extend a Family Kingston is excited to grow this project through the KCCAF, producing food locally and sustainably to support those in need while increasing the climate resiliency of our community. By supporting Growability, you're not only helping to address food security and environmental goals, but also supporting an inclusive program that enriches lives and strengthens our community." Now in its fifth year, the Climate Action Fund continues to support innovative local initiatives that drive climate action and foster community engagement. Thanks to the partnership with KCCU and the generosity of the Kingston community, 100% of donations will directly support the Growability project. Julie Salter-Kean, Manager of Climate Leadership at the City of Kingston, states, quote, "We're thrilled to work with Extend a Family Kingston once again on this transformative initiative. The Growability Hydroponic Greenhouse Project demonstrates the incredible potential for climate action projects to address environmental challenges, and the positive impact it will have on our community cannot be understated," end quote. Donations can be made at all KCCU branches, where contributions will be matched by up to $5,000, as well as online and at the City of Kingston Payment Center. Tax receipts will be distributed for donations of $20, and the city will match up public donations to $15,000. Join us in supporting this year's KCCF recipient. Together, let's grow a greener Kingston. Once again, that was a message directly from the City of Kingston on this year's Kingston Community Climate Action Fund recipient. Kingston Police have released a report covering Queen's Homecoming and Faux Homecoming 2024, reporting only a fraction of the charges seen in other years and no significant incidents. Each year, Homecoming celebrations paint Queen's campus and the surrounding area the tricolor palette of blue, gold, and red, with alumni and current students alike joining in on the school spirit. An unofficial but expected portion of the event also includes a blowout party weekend for current students, entailing the infamous street party on Aberdeen and often a substantial number of fines being dealt out by police and bylaw. However, Kingston residents and visiting alumni may have noticed that both the official homecoming and faux homecoming weekends in October came and went with little commotion this year, especially when compared to the past few years since the pandemic. In 2021 and 2022, Kingston police reported, quote, "hostile and aggressive crowds reaching over 7,000 people on Aberdeen." The reports from those first 2 years of the event's full return following the pandemic included injuries sustained from falling from rooftops and crowd surfing in shopping carts, projectiles being thrown into the crowd and at police, and climbing trees while intoxicated. In 2023, while there was a drop in numbers with an estimated 4,000 students on the street and, quote, "more cooperation and respectful behavior," Kingston police still dealt with a substantial number of residential parties along with the street takeover. A total of 461 charges were dealt out by police and bylaw during homecoming last year. As for this year, Kingston police stated, quote, "this homecoming weekend looked like what a homecoming weekend should. Only 122 charges were dealt out over the 2 weekends, a 74% decrease from 2023, and no serious incidents were reported. with only small house and backyard parties taking place throughout the student district. It was also noted that attendees were, quote, polite, cooperative, and respectful. While it has been routine for Kingston police to declare a nuisance party on Aberdeen and spend most of the day clearing the street, this year all streets remained open. Total costs for policing both homecoming and fake homecoming were $253,000, representing a 29% reduction from last year's total of $359,000. School spirit was still strong during both weekends in October, with a sold-out homecoming football game at Richardson Stadium and no shortage of jackets, frosh overalls, and blue, gold, and red. I sat down with Chief of Kingston Police, Scott Frazier, to discuss what was done differently this year.
There was quite a different tone this year, I believe, in comparison to the past few years since the event returned post-pandemic. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to some of the reasons for that.
Yeah, certainly. So I can tell you, of course, I'm newer to Kingston, coming here as deputy chief at late 2021 and working through as a deputy chief in 22 and then taking over as acting chief in 23. But what I can tell you is that over the past 2 years, we've taken a lot different approach to just the event happening and us showing up. And, what we've really done, we've taken a proactive approach. The students, it was kind of, historically, it was kind of, I guess we could say, adversarial. It was the police versus the students, and really we wanted to change that. So what we did is we came out in certainly 23 with our kind of more of a corporate communication strategy, where we were liaising with the city of Kingston and with the university as well to get the messaging out, because we found by speaking with people, the messaging wasn't getting to the group that we wanted it to get to. So we've kind of, over the last year and a half, improved our messaging strategy. And then we also created in 23 a police liaison team. So the liaison team is they're trained officers who are trained in de-escalation, they're trained in communication, and they're trained to go out non-aggressive and not in uniform to go out and talk to people about, here's what the expectations are and here's what the consequences will be. So outlining that we're certainly here, we want people to be safe. That's what our goal is, safety. And there's laws, and we have to enforce those laws. And there's not a different law because it's a different event. The laws are the same. But we liaised this, and we liaised what our expectations were. We also incorporated using intelligence. You know, there's lots of open source data to tell us what events are taking place, when they're taking place, how many people may be attending. So we use that, and then we target those people to assist us in delivering the messaging of, be safe, you know, don't be down there with alcohol, all of these things, all of the desired outcomes we want, and then collectively having a proactive presence strategy and really being present with our partners and engaging all of our partners. And our partners include, obviously, City Bylaw, who's an excellent resource for our community. You've got Queen's University itself. When we talk about homecoming and fake homecoming and St. Patrick's Day, we have all of our city partners, including KGH Hospital, Hotel Du. You know, we have the Downtown Business Improvement Association. We have transit, all of these people. And we work collectively to provide the most unique opportunity for people and to be safe. So I think when you put that strategy together and the students realize that the police are not your enemy, we're not here, we're not trying to stop people from having fun, but what we are trying to do is prevent people from getting hurt, including officers. We're preventing people from overfilling our emergency rooms at our hospitals. And really, we just want them to have a good time, and we want to show them how they can do it and have a good time and do it safely. And I think we've really seen a turnaround in our police, our response to the students, and the students' response to us. And certainly I go down, I'm present at all these events, and I noticed it distinctly. St. Patrick's Day, homecoming, fake homecoming, it's where we want to go. And our whole goal, we want to reduce our footprint at these events, because if they're safe and they're fun and there's no need for police in mass response, we're going to reduce our costs there. So that's what we're trying to do, be cost efficient. This year we were able to, despite they had a fake homecoming and a homecoming, we reduced our cost by $106,000. So, you know, we're working towards that. Reduce our footprint, reduce our costs, and really, you know, let's have a safe and fun event and work with everyone, including the community, which is the biggest partner of all, because, of course, that area is unique. It's in one side it can be a residence for the university, and the other side can be a home that someone's lived there for 50 years. So we just have to balance that institutional/education institution and a neighborhood. that makes sense.
Thank you for diving right into what Kingston Police did this year. I was wondering if you could also speak a bit to what you were met with, you know, the circumstances with Aberdeen being closed, the first weekend being during your reading week, as well as just the attitude of the students this year.
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, anytime if we start right in September, you know, we come out with our PLT team in September, we come out with enforcement teams in September, so we set the precedent, because every September a new batch of students come in. And we've only been doing this for 2 years, but we're already seeing the impact, because the students who 2 years ago, you know, obviously met this first PLT team and the first new kind of style of policing these events, they're now in their third year going into their fourth year. So, you know, by the time it's a 4-year cycle where everyone in the university then will be versed in how they need to behave in order to generate the response they get from us. And really, you know, so in September when those new students come, a lot of them, it's their first time away from home and it's exciting. And who wouldn't be excited? Kingston's an amazing community. Like, who wouldn't want to be here and who wouldn't want to be out enjoying everything Kingston has to offer? It's awesome. So we're encouraging them to do that, but then we're also laying the rules. And when we lay that out in September, it makes it easier for us. And when it comes to March for St. Patrick's Day, that makes it easier then for homecoming, because there's expectations and everyone knows what they are. So when we did that in September, you know, some people are upset because they got a ticket and stuff, but we saw a reduction this year in the number of tickets that were issued during that period of time. And we also observed a more collegial relationship, the police and the students or people who are attending. And that's exactly what we want. It's not adversarial. There are some times we have to, you know, perform our duty as expected by the community. But if we can be there, keep people safe, keep it as a celebratory event and not turn it into an aggressive event where people are throwing things and there's fights and all that, that's what we're trying to do. Keep it fun, keep people safe, and that's just how we'll continue on. So that's what we were met with. For the most part, we saw a great relationship and we want to continue that moving forward.
Post homecoming, did KP receive any feedback, whether that be from residents or student attendees?
Yep, certainly. And we certainly do a debriefing after all of these events with our community partners. And, you know, obviously you brought it up a little bit earlier, the road being closed, that, you know, that obviously caused a bit of a different situation, because usually that's the area where everybody congregates. So we saw it kind of spread over a larger area this year, just because that spot was not kind of accessible. So we saw that. We understand it's going to be a problem for probably the next few years. However, you know, at the end of the day, you know, in our debriefing, we saw, you know, a much increased, more positive relationship between police and students. We saw a reduction, I think, in, you know, the reduction in the emergency room visits, reduction in people getting hurt, reduction in enforcement. You know, if they're not committing an offense, there's nothing to enforce. And if you look at our 3 years of kind of the last 2.5, 3 years of strategy in regards to ticketing and enforcement and stuff like that, you'll see a very high number and it's slowly reducing. And that's the desired outcome we want. We want our people to be there and unable to find anything bad happening, because that means you're running a successful event. You know, and I akin it to, we have a major rock group or concert come into town. We have officers who are there, but people attend, they know what the rules are, they follow those rules, and there's no enforcement. And if there's something outside of what is deemed to be lawful, then we act. And if everything is lawful, we don't need to act. And so certainly that for us is our desired outcome, and we're starting to see that. And we understand that continuing it is a big effort on the police's part, but the benefit is to the community, so we're going to continue to do that.
Yeah, and how does KP plan to continue this trend in the future?
Yeah, so for us, obviously, I think we have a good recipe right now for success. So continuing the messaging, making sure the messaging is getting to the right people, obviously using our PLT teams to get on the ground and knock on doors and educate students and educate people who are attending, the media, obviously utilizing media messaging, continue to monitor open source intelligence and watch what's happening and try and deal with it before before it does. So watching specific social media sites and things like that, and then once again involving the entire community early on for a collaborative approach. If we attack it from every angle, then you know what? Everybody's covered, everybody's safe, and that's it. Our 100% goal is safety, and when we can go through and say we've had an event and no one got hurt, and the taxpayer can understand that we're spending our money wisely, then obviously it's a win-win for everybody.
Once again, that was Scott Fraser, Chief of Kingston Police, on this year's Homecoming. As the final story in this episode, marking the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women, we will be rebroadcasting a story from last month covering updates on the fight against intimate partner violence in Kingston. Just over a year since Kingston declared intimate partner violence, gender-based violence, and family violence an epidemic, city staff have presented a report covering the action that has been taken on the motion in the last year. In fall 2023, council unanimously declared these pervasive forms of violence an epidemic in the Kingston community. As of today, 95 municipalities and groups, including Boards of Health, the Canadian Federation of University Women, the Association of Municipalities of Ontario, and the Ontario Association of Chiefs of Police, have declared IPV an epidemic. Over the past year, the city and community partners have been collecting data and working on initiatives that have been compiled in the Intimate Partner Violence and Gender-Based Violence one-year update, including a KFLNA public health report in the spring of 2024, providing an overview of violence in the KFLNA area from 2014 to 2021, covering the prevalence of IPV in our community. For example, the report shows that sexual assault and partner violence are the second and third leading causes of violence-related emergency department visits for females in our region. Some of the actions taken in the last year include various strategizing sessions with community partners, awareness initiatives like Consent Awareness Week, and the release of the IPV Survivors Handbook by the Kingston Frontenac Anti-Violence Coordinating Committee, KFACC. I sat down with Ruth Nordegroff, Director of Community Development and Well-being with the City of Kingston, to discuss the contents of the report and the past year of action.
I was wondering if you could share a bit about what resources Kingstonians have now that they maybe didn't have a year ago.
I think it's really important for listeners to know that there is a fabulous coordinating committee in our community called the KFAC, the Kingston and Frontenac Anti-Violence Committee. And that's a kind of a table, a round table with a lot of members that are working in the area of intimate partner violence, family violence, and gender-based violence. And really, I think they are the ones, you know, really holding or creating solutions. What I will say is they've done a fantastic job this year in creating something called the IPV Survivor Handbook, which is a really fantastic and I would say intuitive and accessible online kind of handbook for survivors, obviously all genders, and really kind of directs people where to go and what resources are available. I would say the other thing that I'm really excited about is also just really, again, this is more on the prevention side, but a more of a collaborative approach across the city, the United Way, public health, and the KFAC members on kind of more intentional and collaborative outreach and education. So really looking at like one campaign that's going out on all the social media platforms and not multiple bits and pieces in different places. And I think that really, I hope, kind of starts the conversation and continues the conversation. The last thing I will say is, again, I can go on for forever, but I think on the research and data side, I know there's been a lot of conversation, obviously, around data. But I think starting with the research report that Public Health did is a really good, I think, foundational piece. And building on that, Public Health actually was able to secure some research dollars to continue the research and dive deeper. And then I think I wanted to touch on as well is the two more things. I think there is some work, or there's some really great work happening, again, with the KFAC members around kind of how to create Obviously, not only that kind of digital kind of go-to with a survivor's handbook, but also an app that provides safe access for survivors to services. It also is looking at how do we move to the next level and actually create a look at how potentially a bricks and mortar kind of service or center could look like where survivors could go to. And then lastly, and this is obviously the city's role, is focusing on how we can really build this a kind of intimate partner violence, gender-based violence topic within our community safety and well-being plan, which is a city plan that also then allows us to see how, if and how we're moving the needle on some of these issues, like with data, with interventions and support.
You did mention there the possibility of having a physical center in the future. Does Kingston have something like that now?
Well, that definitely, and I know that is a obviously a hope, like a big dream and hope for the providers. So we don't have that yet. Right now, there are all the different kind of services for survivors are housed within different agencies. So we do not have a center like that. The coordinating committee is really hoping to do the research on what that could look like moving forward, because obviously that would remove barriers for clients, remove transportation challenges, just having everything in one place rather than having to navigate, going to, let's say, police and the hospital and victim services and counseling is obviously like a lot, especially when you're dealing with a very precarious, challenging situation in your life.
And have you been receiving feedback from community members on action so far? What are they saying?
There's a lot of amazing feedback around like how important this work is. I think we're just really at the beginning. So I think there's still a lot to touch on. But I would say overall, I think people really and this is really what I'm hoping for, that people just feel like this is something we can talk about in the community, and that we can really remove barriers and ultimately, prevent intimate partner violence from happening. I'm a parent, I have teens, and I really think it's important that we put this, like, and it's an uncomfortable conversation, but put this into the line, take it out of kind of, I think, shame and really make sure people feel that this is something that, first of all, we can prevent, and second, if there is an instance of violence, that there is a service for people to go to and they feel safe.
You've touched on this in all your answers, but what's kind of on the horizon? What can we expect in the next year?
Well, first of all, we need to continue the collaboration and have, more. I think this year we really started to kind of understand what's out there, what kind of communication do we already have, and how can we collaboratively share information in the community. I hope in 2025 we can continue on that path and actually get into more focused education and awareness campaigns. I also am really looking forward to have continue our research and our data collection, so we can get every time, I feel like the picture will continue to get better. And then, of course, I'm really hoping that the KFAC committee is successful with their grant application to really look at kind of what could a bricks and mortar center look like in the next couple of years, so we can, that's obviously the providers working on that. Could that be something that could be in the future in Kingston? And I think, I just really hope that we kind of, as a community, can continue to be brave and have this conversation, and also, really look at how can we support our young people with the right information, so they, know what's appropriate and what's not, and where they can go for help if they need to.
Once again, that was Ruth Nordegroff on the recently released IPV and GBV one-year update report, covering what the city of Kingston has done since declaring IPV and GBV an epidemic last year. I also sat down with Paula McLaughlin, Executive Director of Victim Services of Kingston and Frontenac, and member of the Kingston Frontenac Anti-Violence Coordinating Committee, to discuss ongoing initiatives, including the possibility of a one-stop shop center in Kingston's future. Here is a bit of our conversation.
I was wondering if you could describe a bit more about what KFACC is for folks who aren't aware.
So the Kingston and Frontenac Anti-Violence Coordinating Committee is a committee that includes a lot of different social services. So we have the Kingston Interval House, Sexual Assault Center, Resolve Counseling, Victim Services, our police partners, Family and Children's Services, and a lot of other organizations that come together to discuss community strategies and initiatives that will support survivors of gender-based violence, and also put together lots of different things like public education and awareness about gender-based violence. And we also have a survivors group that contributes to the conversation as well, that ensures that survivors' voices are heard in all of the initiatives of KFAC.
Thank you. And sort of starting us off before we get into some of those more specific initiatives, in the last year since the city has acknowledged this as the epidemic that it is, do you find that that declaration has made a big difference?
We've definitely felt a surge of attention since it's been declared an epidemic in our county. In particular, you know, having the city involved and in discussions with us about what gender-based violence looks like in our community, but also what we're doing as a community to respond to that in prevention or response of gender-based violence has made a really big difference. So with the declaration, we've had more people wanting to be involved and offer their voices to our different initiatives, including having it put into our safety and well-being plan with the city of Kingston, and also bringing the voices together on larger projects as well to see how we can all come together and collaboratively address a lot of the issues that we've seen.
One of the really big projects that came out of this year was the Survivor's Handbook. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about that project and how it's been helping Kingstonians since it came out.
Sure. The Survivor's Handbook that was put together by KFAC includes a lot of different things, from education about what intimate partner violence looks like, and a lot of the different services and supports that are available to survivors. It also has a lot of different elements like safety planning, so that survivors can actually document some of their own safety plans and keep notes within that handbook as well. So it works as a functioning document that can be tailored to the survivor. It also includes different elements like QR codes, which will directly link survivors to support network websites and different elements like that. So this handbook is made to be able to be used by all of the different social and justice services. As well, survivors can find it online to use on their own without being directed to it by a different service too, which is really nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also saw in the report the possibility of a full center in the future to address this issue. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to where that project is at and what it could mean for Kingston if we're able to have something like that in our future.
So the concept of a one-stop shop has not been a new idea for the Kingston and Frontenac Anti-Violence Coordinating Committee. It's been something that's been on our wish list for a lot of years, and we've previously done a lot of research into what that could look like in the Kingston community. The struggle with a concept like that, though, is of course funding and how to start up these large projects. What the one-stop shop is an actual physical location where survivors would be able to receive support from all of the different community services and police in one building. So that means survivors aren't left to try to navigate complex systems on their own, going to different places, multiple appointments, in navigating independently a really complex system, they would be able to receive wraparound support in one building all at once. So this just kind of speaks to the collaborative efforts of the community and how much we're working together in the best interest of survivors. But of course, opening a physical location is a very expensive endeavor. So for that, we have struggled in the past to find funding sufficient enough to start up. But recently, our Ontario government put out a call for proposals, and we have put in an application for those startup funds for an amount of just below about $1.9 million to help us start this initiative. And we'll hear whether or not we were successful in that, hopefully here in December. So if we are successful, then that means we're going to be able to open the center and fund it for 2 years, in which case we'll have to create a strategic plan and approach for additional funding after the 2 years.
That's great. Yeah, and folks can see all the details on both your previous projects in the last year and upcoming in the report that was shared with City Council. But I was also wondering, what are you looking forward to in the next year as we continue to tackle this issue as a community?
I think we're all just looking forward to continuing to work together as a community to respond to gender-based violence. We have really recognized how well Kingston works together and how much the community partners have come together with the voice of survivors as well, to continue the really hard work that we do. And so we really look forward to continuing that work and ensuring that our initiatives are inclusive and survivor-led as well. And I think that there are some really great things coming for the Kingston community and for survivors.
Coming up, November 25th kicks off 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, an annual international campaign that starts on the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women and runs until Human Rights Day on December 10th. The December 6th National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women also falls in this timeline. Throughout this surge, municipalities and groups making the declaration have been urging the province to do the same. Provincial Bill 173, the Intimate Partner Violence Epidemic Act, was put forward in March 2024. It has had a second reading ordered and was referred to Standing Committee in April 2024. There have been no further updates. Once again, that was a rebroadcasted story from last month in honor of the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women. Before we wrap up this morning, we're going to run through your Friday forecast, a roundup of just some of the events Kingston has to offer this weekend. Tonight, City Hall will be illuminated white and purple for the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women. White and purple ribbons are worn on this day to remember the 14 female engineering students who were murdered at L'École Polytech de Montréal on December 6, 1989, in an act of gender-based violence. It is also a day to reflect on all women whose lives have been harmed or lost due to gender-based violence. Saturday, December 7th marks the beginning of Downtown Kingston's free trolley and carriage rides program. Experience the magic of Downtown Kingston in winter. Pickup and drop-off is at Springer Market Square. On Sunday, December 8th, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Be sure to drop by to enjoy artisanal crafts and music. As for concerts coming up this weekend, tonight, A Celtic Christmas with Turpin's Trail will be taking place at the club at the RCHA from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Tickets are $20. The Holy Wow album fundraiser for When the Devil Goes Blind will be kicking off at 8:30 p.m. tonight at the Hotel Wolf Island. This will include a live concert and video release extravaganza. Special guests include Sarah O'Neill and Matt Almeida. Tickets are $15 to $20. Tonight at 5 p.m. at the Museum of Lennox in Addington, Friday Night Lights at the Museum. Listen to live music, explore the galleries, and make festive creations and more. This event is free. Tomorrow, on Saturday, December 7th, the Gertrudes will be playing at the Hotel Wolf Island. Tomorrow night at Tir na n'Og, the Celtic Kitchen Party will be playing traditional and contemporary Celtic, Irish, and Scottish covers and originals. Show starts at 9 p.m. and runs until midnight. On Sunday, December 8th, from 1 to 4 p.m., the Kildeers will be live at McKinnon Brothers Brewery. This is a free show. On Sunday from 2:30 to 4:30, Holiday Magic. Orchestra Kingston rings in the holidays with Melodia Choir and Ronan Hendry. This show is taking place at the Spire and is $20 to $25. That wraps up our events and concerts for this weekend. If you'd like to add one to our online and on-air concert and events calendar, you can reach out today via cfrc.ca. And don't forget to follow CFRC on Instagram at cfrcmusic. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Coming up next for CFRC's afternoon lineup, at noon we have Democracy Now! Syndicated daily global news with Amy Goodman. At 1 p.m., join Corey and Madeline for Close Reads, sharing and analyzing creative writing by students at Queen's. At 1:30, join Samar for Melodies of Myth, a storytelling radio show blending mini-stories with the rich sounds of Indian classical and Western music. At 2 p.m., we have Whiplash, Anything and Everything with DJ LFN. Stay tuned for all these programs and so much more right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.